Welcome to the Beyond Jiu-Jitsu podcast. This is episode 155. My name is Kieran Lefebvre, the one and only, and I'm joined by Adam Childs. Come on,
my man. Name is Adam Childs. There's two of me, so not the one and only. Episode 155.
Okay, I'm definitely not the only Kieran Lefebvre. Random story. When I was in the Navy, there was another Kieran Lefebvre spelt exactly the same as my name, right?
Really?
Yes, really, really. And we joined, get this, 1 month apart. So he joined 4 weeks before me. So we joined the Navy practically at the same time. He was a sailor. I was an officer. And at one point, we served on the same ship. And we were at the same training establishment for like a year. It was crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I was so mad because he joined before me. So he, with our emails in the defense, it's like your first name, a dot, like a period, and then your last name. And then if there's multiple of you, there's numbers, and the numbers just keep going up. Like I met a Matthew Smith and he was like 57 or something. Matthew Smith, 57. So there's 57 Matthew Smiths in the defense force. I was Kieran Dot Lefebvre 1. So there's one other guy and he joined fucking 4 weeks. So we always got each other's emails. I got his like, sensitive personal reporting sent to me all the time, and people sent emails to him like, oh, hey, sir, blah, blah, blah. And he would always forward them and he's like, oh, hey, sir, like fucking, here's another one for you. It's so funny.
That's funny because like, I don't really come across people with my same last name, Childs. Although the other, only like last week or the week before, I was at Woolworths for international listeners. That's like supermarket, like Whole Foods or whatever. And you know, your little Woolworths card that you scan, and I guess your name comes up on the cashier's computer. And the guy was like, oh, Charles, that's, you know, he's like, same last name. He's like, oh, you're related to these people, blah, 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 down who live here. And I was like, nah, no idea. But, you know, but your story is funny because I believe for some reason, I feel I've mentioned this before, but my brother's name's David. So David Childs, he had all through high school a guy in his year in his same year at the same school, obviously, and his last name was David Child without the S. So my last name is as if someone doesn't know the plural for child, right? They've just put an S on the end. So this guy's name was David Child. They were in the same year, multiple classes together. So they kind of just they weren't friends. Like they operated in different circles. I don't know. I guess that's normal for all high schools. You see it in American film and whatever. You got the jocks and you got the whatever. Our school was mostly separated into three groups. It was either what we called the footy heads, so the people who played rugby league, rugby union, whatever. So we had the footy heads, we had the skateboarders, hippie types, which is what the group that the potheads that was the group that me and my brother were in, and then you had kind of everybody else. So they didn't run in the same circles. They weren't friends, but yeah, all through their high school, whenever one got in trouble, and it wasn't like they were caught red-handed, they just got in trouble or received a letter or whatever. They were always like, no, 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 it's David Child. And then the other, he would obviously be like, no, 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 it was David Childs. You know, you guys got us mixed up.
Sneaky bastards. Yeah.
Anyway, it's episode 155. I'm excited for this episode. It's the second edition of our what we've been working on techniques, what we've learned over the last 10 weeks, so roughly 3 months. But before we get into that, I know you don't want to talk about it, Kieran, but let's go over the competition on the weekend.
Yeah. So we mentioned previous episode that I was competing, I was training for this competition, blah, blah, blah. Didn't go well. I lost. I lost the second round and I lost the bronze match. It was very embarrassing. It's probably one of the most embarrassing performances that I've had. I've had enough time now to really digest it and reflect on it. I was very angry. You know, everyone's thinking like, bro, it's a fucking blue belt. Calm down. But I've competed a lot, you know, and in my world, I should have ran through them. No offense.
Yeah, I also want to, sorry to, sorry to interrupt. I also want to back you up in your kind of feelings of frustration, just in the, just like you made my ears pricked up when you said it's just a blue belt comp, because I remember when I lost a competition at white belt, and this was in Canada, my first ever jiu-jitsu coach. So long-time listeners will know that I received my black belt from Fabio Gurgel, the head coach of Alliance. But I originally started under a guy called Shane Rice. Shane Rice was one of only two non-Brazilians to receive his black belt from Hicks and Gracie. So Shane Rice, obviously incredible. Like, imagine nowadays saying you're a black belt from, well, I mean, most people don't know who Hickson is nowadays. You pull aside a white belt nowadays, they don't know who he is. But you know what I mean. Like, he's obviously a very credible black belt. And when I started competing at white belt, I think I won my first however many competitions. I can't remember. My first ever comp I won, put a dude to sleep in the final, who, funnily enough, I didn't realize this prior to starting this anecdote, connects to your frustration, because the dude I fought in the final had like no rest time. And anyway, but I remember I lost a comp and he said to me something along the lines of, man, it doesn't matter, it's just a white belt comp. He didn't say it in a dismissing my feelings way, just in a, it's okay, like, don't worry about it. But I remember at the time thinking, yeah, it's just a white belt comp, but I am a white belt. Therefore, like, it matters to me, you know, the same way that, like, you get your heart broken when you're 15 years old. The chances of that partner probably being your soulmate and longtime, you know, wife, husband or whatever, very minimal. But when you're 15, like, it matters at that moment. So, yeah, it's just a blue belt comp. But, I mean, you're like, well, yeah. I mean, it's easy for you as a black belt to say it doesn't matter because you're a black belt, but I'm a blue belt, so it fucking matters.
But the thing is, man, I've lost before. I've competed so many times. Like, you don't compete as often as I have and not fucking lose unless you're an absolute prodigy. I'm not a prodigy. I've lost before, man. I've lost before. I've never lost like this. And I'm so glad it's not filmed. It probably is. I think it was recorded at some point, but I'm so glad. I don't want anyone to see it. It's people are going to dig it up now, but it was so bad. I'm not even mad about the second match. The second match where I lost on points, I was actually up on points at one point. I rushed a submission on the back. I rushed a bow and arrow choke and he got out. And then from there I gassed. So I thought I was going to finish him and I just gassed out. And, you know, I still tried, I scrambled, blah, 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 lost on points barely. I think I lost by like 3 points or something, or 2 points or something like that. And it was a really good match. The referee was like, match of the day, boys, you know, fucking amazing jiu-jitsu, all this sort of shit. It was a really good match. But then I only had about 4 minutes in between that match and the bronze. And I was so devastated. I was really disappointed. The guy that I fought in the bronze match, he had multiple matches in between. I had one match and it was finished on a submission. So it was like 4 minutes or whatever. So I didn't get my regulation 12. And I was gassed, disappointed, all that sort of shit. And I pretty much just gave up. You know what I mean? The guy that I fought in the final, no offense to him, like, whatever. I feel like if we were both at the same level of fatigue, I would have fucking destroyed him. And I just gave up. And I was stuck in mount for the whole 6 minutes. I didn't let him submit me at least, but it was just so pathetic. And that's what I'm disappointed about. I'm not disappointed about I am disappointed about losing the one that I feel like I shouldn't have, the semifinal. But the bronze match was so embarrassing. I've never, ever, ever experienced that in a competition ever, even close. And it's fucking rough. And I get what you're saying, like, but I had so much pressure on myself because I feel like, you know, if I'm gunning for a purple belt, I should not be losing blue belt matches in this way. I should not. And I did. And it was a huge, huge fucking slap in the face, a massive wake up call. You know, and again, very dramatic, but jiu-jitsu is not just a hobby to me. It's something that I'm, you know, looking to pursue. So, you know, you can laugh and whatever and be like, oh, you know, this guy's fucking a bit of a, you know, a prima donna crying over fucking losing a blue belt match. But that's what I've come to realize, is that it was a huge wake up call, a massive wake up call. So yeah.
Yeah, but you know, like, yeah, sometimes you need that, don't you? Sometimes that, sometimes that slap in the face is just what you need, you know. And you see that, like, I know, I know that going way back on these episodes, there's been a lot of strong opinions on Joe Rogan and whatever, but it was during a different period of what the world was going through and whatever. Anyway, I don't want to dig that up, but Joe Rogan clips pop up a lot on my reels, shorts, whatever you want to call it, because algorithms do their thing. And he obviously has a lot of interesting guests, and I don't listen to his podcast. I kind of actually only really have one podcast I listen to, which is this
Beyond
one.
Beyond Jiu-Jitsu podcast.
which is the Lex Fridman podcast. It's definitely my favorite podcast. I really like it.
Your favorite? Ooh, okay.
Yeah, way better than this one, bro.
You're not wrong.
yeah, but anyway, he was, you know, whether it's a loss or whatever, but he was talking about something changed in Charles Oliveira after he had a kid, and now he's just this different fight. They were like, man, people remember Charles for like at his low points when Cub Swanson knocked him out or whatever. It's like, but man, something changed in that dude once he became a dad. Like, he's like a whole different animal now. And you know, whether it's that or whether it's a loss or something, you know, and you see it. Yep. You see people lose in combat sports where they, I know we're getting a bit off topic, but when people talk about the GOAT of MMA, and obviously, like, probably currently most people, the guy who's most at the forefront is, people mention Khabib all the time and whatever, and then people argue, hey, he didn't have enough title defenses and this and that. Man, in my opinion, the absolute best of all time in MMA is George St. Pierre, because to come back, like, and beat people that have beaten you, you know, like, the dude only has two losses on his record, and he, you know, in, if you can call it this, undid both those losses, like, came back and, you know, like, and that's for me sort of an example of, like, maybe the loss was what was required to, you know.
I agree. And I found that with myself, dude. I think that I almost needed this, because I'm going to be honest, I was getting too cocky, too arrogant, and not putting in the work to back it up. You know what I mean? I spoke to my friend Filippo. Shout out to Filippo. He was saying, like, oh, bro, you've moved countries. You know, everything's different. You're not in your normal routine. Look at what you've done in the last, like, 6 months. You've been here, there, and everywhere. You know, you're not training as consistently as you were, you know, this and that, and blah, blah, blah. And obviously, my jiu-jitsu hasn't gotten worse. It's just, you know, in some areas I've improved a lot, like a lot. But in other areas, things, you know, that I took for granted previously because of how much I was training and the training, the type of sparring I was doing, and, you know, insert all the excuses in here. You know, now I've come to realize that I can't train, you know, I can't just train two times a week, you know, half-ass my cardio and then expect to still be this, like, fucking, you know, cardio beast in comps, you know, when I'm going up against other competitive blue belts, other people with similar matches to me or whatever, right? I just can't, you know, it's unrealistic. It's too arrogant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, like, if you're reminding me of, I'm going to sort of paraphrase a bit of a speech I gave at the end of class last week. I don't often give, like, speeches at the end of class, but, you know, at our gym, we line up at the end of class just to kind of high five. Yeah. To high five everyone, you know, and just thank each other for training and whatever. But, you know, sometimes something's on my mind and, or something happens in the class, or there's an upcoming thing, and, you know, I take the opportunity to have everyone lined up in front of me and mention it. And there was a particular person who had had quite a rough class, not in the sense they got hurt or anything, but they just got mentally pretty broken. And I was like, lined everyone up and I was like, guys.
Chad? It was Chad, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Chad got pumped.
Maybe. Maybe. Shit.
Oh, this is, for those that don't know, Chad's a legend, but 100% Chad.
Chad's actually one of my favorite people. Wears his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah, lovely, lovely man. But if anyone is going to get broken, it's Chad.
Well, no, you can't break Chad. Like
that's
Chad.
True. That's true. Chad, he's resilient.
It doesn't matter. You think you broke him, he'll be there tomorrow. Like you can't break him, right? Like,
no, but what I meant is because he wears his heart on his sleeve, it's easy to see in his eyes.
When he's had a bad training session.
Yeah.
And so I lined everyone up and I was like, guys, you know, show of hands who here that every single time they've turned up to jiu-jitsu has like had a good time or had good training. I was like, no one put their hand up. And I was like, okay, hands up here who lifts weights or has lifted weights. Hands up who every single time they've walked into the gym to lift weights, they hit a PB. Okay, a bunch of people here surf. Hands up here who every time you've gone to surf, you've caught the wave of your life. Yeah. No, fucking nobody, right? Yeah. Like there's good days and bad days, and I know the bad days suck, and I was saying that I left the gym in Brazil, obviously different because I was pursuing jiu-jitsu as a career, so there was way more at stake, if you will. But I mean, I left the gym multiple times with like my eyes watering, like, you know, a millimeter away from, you know, busting into tears, wanting to quit. Just like I had plenty of fucking shit days, you know, and I know it's hard in the moment, but, you know, I was like, man, okay, this was a Friday. I said, today I actually trained really well. I actually had a fucking balling session and everything I did worked and whatever. But I said, on Tuesday, it sucked. I left the gym on Tuesday and I'm a black belt rolling with blue belts and purple belts, but I still left on a Tuesday for my personal goals and what I was working on. I was like, that fucking sucked.
Like working on heel hooks?
Nah, man, I don't have to work on heel hooks. I get caught in them all the time. Heel hooks left, right, and center. What are you talking about? Yeah. No, but and so you have the good and the bad and, you know, like it's easy to, like you said, take it for granted or whatever when you're in that routine and whatever. And, you know, maybe the wake up call was necessary.
It's very necessary. It's very necessary. Hindsight's 20/20 and it's only been like fucking, you know, 48 hours, right? It's Monday and I competed on Saturday. It's I think that I needed to lose. I think, well, it's easy to say. Obviously I wanted to win, obviously, but I think I needed to lose just to, you know, bring me back down to earth a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, obviously not to brush it off. Now it's been a few days and whatever. You look at the bigger picture. I don't think there's many people, Gordon Ryan included, who went undefeated from white belt to black belt, you know, like it's, you know, it's, but, and it's also not even, it's not like you have to, getting off topic, but yeah, anyway, it's not like you have to be the best blue belt in the world to earn your purple belt anyway. Like, you know, like it's, I know you want that feeling of, you know, if I'm expecting my purple belt, I should be winning at blue belt or I shouldn't be performing like this at blue belt. But obviously, I don't need to tell you this, you know deep down that there's no way in the world you would let your next competition play out like this.
No.
There's no way in the world.
No. I'd rather die. Yeah. You know, I just, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think I learned a lot about myself as well. Like I got into a well that was so deep in fatigue. I'm talking about the third match where I just literally gave up. I felt myself giving up and I told myself in my mind, are you giving up right now? Like, are you, particularly when there was only like a minute left, there's no way of coming back. I, you know, and I was still trying, but it's kind of like, you know, I've been in positions in competitions where I've seen my opponent underneath me just give up, and I'm looking at you like, I could see you've quit. And I felt like I was doing that. I was like quitting, you know, and that was deep. I didn't think I'd ever do that. You know what I mean? I've never done that before. Even in training, I very, very rarely have that experience, you know.
Like to put this into perspective for people, I watched Kieran compete once. Was the triangle fiasco at white belt or blue belt? I can't remember.
White belt.
Kieran was in a triangle for so long. And man, long story short, I can't remember if you ended up tapping or the match ended. I can't quite recall. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I ended up tapping, yeah.
But he was in it for so long that he ended up – it was actually really embarrassing. I was yelling at the ref. So a lot of these – I imagine this might be the same everywhere. I'm not sure. But in Australia, a lot of the competitions, 50% of the refs will be – Brazilian. And so I'm yelling at the ref in Portuguese because Kieran was like fucked, man. Like, and he's trying, Kieran couldn't even stand up. He had had blood flow restriction for so long. He couldn't even stand up. And the ref's like about to give him penalty. He's already lost the match, but the ref's going to give him penalties because he's like making Kieran stand up so he can raise it. And I'm yelling at the ref like, bro, what the fuck are you doing? Get the medics, whatever, blah, blah, blah. The paramedics came over and it was probably like you sat with them probably for 45 minutes to an hour before you could even stand up. Like you were so like if you were near a hospital, you would have been put on a drip for sure. You were fucked, bro. And so
pretty bad, yeah.
So Kieran doesn't give up, and I've rolled with Kieran so many times to, you know, like you remind me a little bit of Nicholas where it's like something that needs to break or pop because you're not going to tap.
Particularly with these fucking angles. Nicholas is a very, very good blue belt, and he will let shit go until it's going to break with his fucking ankles. Like he just does not, and he's so stoic. Like you cannot read his expression, even if like he might be dying. Like, and then he would come. Did you have him in a footlock? He didn't tap or something, and you heard a pop, and then you let it go. You're like, "How's your ankle?" He's like, "Oh, it's fine." And the next day, he comes with it taped.
Yeah. I had a similar thing years ago, actually, with Ari. So,
oh really?
Ari Tabak. One of Australia's like top black belts and active competitors, years ago when we were like purple brown belts or something, it was a similar sort of thing. He didn't want to tap, and I straight foot locked him. This sounds like I'm talking shit on Ari. Ari smoked me many a times. Ari's a very, 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 very good, but it was just training, right? It was just a roll, but he didn't want to tap. And it wasn't like I was like, you're not going to tap. And I reefed it, but like I just straight foot locked him and, you know, when it popped. Actually, I don't even think he tapped in the roll. I don't think I tapped him. I think it popped and I let go or whatever. And dude had his ankle strapped for like 6 weeks after that.
You know? Stubborn. So stubborn. But, yeah, man. Yeah. There you go. Fuck.
This is the perfect segue because let's actually get into the episode. I mean, I wouldn't call that a 20-minute intro because we spoke about a lot of different things. But
you know what, this episode could be like just titled Dealing with a Loss and What We've Been Working With.
It could be, yeah.
I'll do that.
But let's get into what I have been working on. And last episode 145 was a uber deep dive really into Troy Bars because it was I discovered a lot about that submission position and how I went about learning it and figuring it out by myself and whatever. Not as in I didn't look at other resources, but when I was problem solving by myself. This one's a little bit shorter for me because it's a more like Troy Bars is a newer position, submission, whatever you want to call it, if you will. Whereas a straight foot lock is not. And that's where I'm hence the segue. So what I had been working on for the last 10 weeks, 3 months, were straight foot locks. Before I dive into that though, I want to know what you were working on, which I believe I already do, but I actually want to let you go first because last 10 episodes ago, I just took the whole episode with Troy Bars. And I believe if you let me go off with Footlocks, I'll go for another 40 minutes and then you won't get to talk about what you're working on. So I want you to go first because you can talk about what you're working on, what you've learned, what you've realized. I can give my input and then we go from there.
So here's the thing. Technically, I had it like planned out that I was working on X-Guard and single leg X. And any form of entry to X-Guard, just working on X-Guard, basically using the strength in my legs, you know, as a physical attribute because it's a really good position for me. That's what I've been working on. But what I found is this whole time between when we've done the Choi Bar episode and now, I've actually been working on Choi Bars. I haven't been working on – like I've been working on X-Guard, but – 9 times out of 10 in my roles, I'm not actually ending up in that position. I'm not putting myself in that position. I'm putting myself in an initialed half guard and I'm getting Choi Bars. I'm fucking getting Choi Bars left, right, and center. Like it is what I'm constantly hunting for. I love that entry. I love it. It's so good.
We might be able to quite organically change the format of these reoccurring episodes where it could be that I talk about what I've been working on and then you go, yeah, wow, never thought about it like that.
And then you
work on it and then sort of regurgitate a little bit.
But I will say from that Choi Bar position, I have learned so much about it. I think that it is so effective, right? So for those that don't know, the Choi Bar entry that we're talking, there's Choi Bar entries from many different positions, but what we're specifically talking about is a Choi Bar entry from a high knee, like from a high knee shield, and you go over the top for an armbar entry on the far side, or you can do a Kimura, you can do whatever. Okay, now I have learned a lot about that position. I love if you go back and listen to episode 145 when Adam did take a deep dive into Choi Bars, you'll know what I'm talking about, but. When you see Choi Bars taught on YouTube or whatever, a lot of the time they tell you to weave your leg all the way through and take the armbar. But I actually really love the detail where you stop and put your foot on the hip on their whatever, your leg goes over the top and you stop on that hip because the amount of leverage you can get, even if the opponent is technically stronger than you or as strong as you, they just cannot hold the grip. You will always break their grip if you're kicking with your leg on their fucking hip and deadlifting back. There's no way you can stop it, right? And I haven't been getting arm bars.
Yeah, I was just going to reiterate what you said. Energy expenditure aside, like obviously you might, by the time you get to the position, you've maybe used 99% of your gas tank and they've used 20% of theirs. Maybe the deadlift isn't enough. But like you said, all things being even, there's no way your deadlift is not breaking that grip.
It's always breaking it. And I'm not just getting arm bars from there because sometimes, you know, they can roll and I can lose the arm bar. I'm actually taking a lot of Kimuras from that position.
Yeah, so Kimura is a strong position for you. But if you go back, so quick shout out to, I believe it's, hang on, give me 2 seconds to make sure I don't get this wrong. But the, Alec Balding. So Alec Balding, BJJ. He's Alec is an incredibly, incredibly good jiu-jitsu practitioner, has a lot of really cool content online. But a few weeks ago, he posted a YouTube video about Choi Bars that he actually referenced our podcast episode. So shout out to Alec. Alec is incredible at jiu-jitsu. You guys should go check him out. Alec Balding. I'll put a link
in the description.
Yeah, nice. So go check him out. But he referenced our Choi Bar episode and spoke about how the Choi Bar is superior-ish because of that position. And it cut to a bit where I was talking about how I feel really weak when I reach for the Kimura because my shoulders aren't really strong. You're quite strong there. But but jumping off from what you said, whether you're getting a Choi Bar, which is essentially just a belly down armbar, or a Kimura, yeah, I don't necessarily always get the Choi Bar, but if I get the entry to the Choi Bar, for me, I'm either getting a Choi Bar slash arm bar, or I'm taking the back, or it's converting into an inverted triangle or a regular triangle or whatever. Like if I get the entry, as in I get that foot on the hip position that you're talking about, I'm getting something from there. Unless there's in saying that, like I've been there with Casper, which Kira knows is a massive, massive, super strong dude at the gym. And sometimes I get nowhere from there, but
that's fair enough.
But you know, so you've been working on Tory bars, so that's cool.
Well,
have you had? Well, no, okay. Well, I'm happy to.
I don't know. I love it.
No, that's all right.
I love the position.
Well, I'm happy to talk more about the straight foot locks, but before I do, then let me ask: has there been any sort of any things that you can mention or light bulb moments or whatever that you could mention for you? Because you have a complete, I mean, I'd be asking the same question even if you were a black belt. You've got it's got nothing to do with the belt disparity. It's the you're a completely different body type to me. And a different game, right? Has there been anything that you have realized or any holes that you have questions about or whatever regarding Tory bars?
The one thing that I will say that I've realized even up until as recently as yesterday, because I trained, I was so mad about the comp that I went and did the training in the gym that is further away from where I live. Anyway, even that training session, I got a few really nice Tory bar entries. And what I will say is I've found I can get to that position without even needing my knee to be on the right side of the head. I can still get to that Tory bar position with my leg on the wrong side and still flip it over and still get there. And that's one thing, you know, when I first started the Tory bars.
You lost me a little bit. Like I think
okay.
I know what you mean, but can you extrapolate on that? Like how are you not ending up just flattened out chest to chest?
I have no fucking clue. I have no clue, but I've been able to. I know it's very, very hard. I did seek out some like, you know, private feedback on the Tory bar episode to see if it was something that we wanted to do, like that style of trying to explain technique over audio. And the feedback was mixed. Some people loved it. Some people I was so lost. So I'm going to try and, you know, be careful on how I explain this. But in the Tory bar position, when you have the high knee shield, right? Say you're, you know, I'm on my right side. I have the high knee shield. I get the, you know, underhook on the arm. I have my gable grip on the shoulder or the elbow, wherever. It doesn't matter. Instead of having my knee on the same side as I have the shoulder grip, right, and pushing the head away so I can get my foot over the top, I don't know how, but sometimes I can just throw my leg over the top of the head, get it all the way over, and then climb up on top.
I see what you mean. Yeah, so – you can, yeah. So sometimes you can take your whole – so instead of having to put your shin on their neck to push them away and then windshield wiper your foot over the top, sometimes you can just throw your whole leg and your hamstring just goes.
Exactly.
So I without seeing how it's playing out and without feeling it done on me, just in this very – not vague, because I know exactly what you're talking about, so vague's not the right word, but just in this like conversational explanation of it, I would wonder if it's a case of you getting away with it against particular training partners rather than it actually – because, there's times – sorry, wait, hang on.
Normally what happens though is I use that entry. I don't go all the way through. I throw my whole leg over the top. I have my foot planted on the hip. So imagine the head's in the way sometimes still. My leg's all the way over the top. I've sort of gone all the way over my side and I take the Kimura from there. And it's a super dominant Kimura. So it's not really a Tory bar entry, is it?
Yeah. I mean,
look,
you can draw a lot of parallels between the Tory bar entry and what was rampant in jiu-jitsu maybe how far back? I'm just looking at a calendar, maybe like 6 years ago or something, the whole Kimura trap system.
Yeah.
You know, okay. So that sort of throwing your leg the whole way over the top, it's almost like you've probably – I don't know if you've realized it, but for sure, if you haven't, you will when I say it. Sometimes you almost, that throwing your leg over the top, you'll almost have to do some type of invert-ish movement to gain mobility in your hip to throw your, to get the space you need to throw your leg over their head.
That's exactly what's happening.
That's not too dissimilar to quite a, well, when I say well-known, like, I mean, well-known, I guess, if you're a black belt, but maybe not so for everyone, but the typical Kimura trap where you get the Kimura, roll over the top. If they sit up, you take you their back.
But if
they sit up and make it to their knees and what would look like it's going to be side control bottom for you, you can do this kind of pendulum invert and you end up sort of like on their back or in this sort of choi bar-ish position where you then continue attacking the Kimura. So you could blur those lines a little bit. And again, without feeling it, without seeing it, whatever, obviously there's a bit of an overlap that's happening there. And again, I don't know if I said it in the choi bar episode, but if you used a, in air quotes, choi bar entry to then do a Kimura, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm. It's the same thing when I talk about to my students about body lock passing. They expect a body lock pass to be like, I'm going from butterfly guard, butterfly half, whatever it is. I got my body lock. I connect my hands. I've got like a 10 finger grip or a gable grip or whatever it is.
You go to side control.
And they go to side control. It's like, man, sometimes the body lock serves the purpose to you getting a cross face chest to chest with an underhook. And then like it served its purpose. Move on from the body lock. You know,
get head control and pass their fucking half guard where they're flattened out. Exactly.
Yeah. So like if a, you know, there's the choi bar as a whole could cast a wide net. Like I, again, little air finger quotes for people who are just what listening to the audio. I hit choi bars from when my opponent's turtled, right? And I can't get a seatbelt or hooks in and I dive on a choi bar position. Like I'm turtle on top and I'll like jump on a choi bar-ish position from there and start attacking the arm.
Yeah,
you know, like, yeah, well, that's interesting. I'll look forward to feeling it, seeing
it. I'll never hit it on you.
Well, no, you never know. Like, fuck, I've got – people go on about how tall I am, and I'm like, yeah, do you understand how leverage works? It's like I can create a lot of leverage, but a lot of leverage can be, used against me. Like, and I mean, look, you know how I roll. Like, I'm not the sort of person who trains being like, I will never have a lower belt submit me. Like, I get submitted all the time in fucking training. You've heel hooked me multiple times, multiple times. I keep trying to improve my outside heel hook defense from, you know, single leg X, outside ashy, cross ashy, which I'm terrible. You know, my heels are the size of a Everest, but, you know, I'm really terrible there. And, I don't give a shit. Like,
Take it better.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I would not be surprised at all if you choi bar me in training. I'll be mad about it, but I wouldn't be surprised.
But it's so I find it really interesting. I will just as like a to cap it off that I didn't expect this to happen. That you would like spend, you know, we spent a whole hour basically, a whole podcast episode talking about the choi bar. I had the advantage of having a visual aid while you were explaining it, which helped a lot. And then from that, I was able to then implement it pretty much the next day in training. Obviously, it took me a little bit of time because you weren't there showing me, but I was able to then implement the technique that you explained by audio and I saw on YouTube and literally like put it into practice after playing with the position, using what you were, you know, the things that you discovered over the however many weeks you were working on it. And, it's been one of the most successful implementations of a technique into my game I've ever experienced in jiu-jitsu, and I'm very
It's so good because even if you don't get like in the episode I spoke a lot about how, you know, this your lower arm has this ability to like flip the wrist so you get the internal rotation on the shoulder. But if you can even just get that it's almost like one or the other. If you get the flip on the wrist and you get that sort of Kimura position happening in your opponent's shoulder and elbow and wrist, it's then almost guaranteed that you're going to be able to get your leg over their head. Mm-hmm. But it also goes the other way. Like if you just get the gable grip and then can get your leg over the head, you're then in such a good position that you're almost guaranteed to get the elbow flip or the wrist
flip.
That's
what I normally get. I normally end up in the second variation where I just have such a strong – I focus on the gable grip and crunch their shoulder or their elbow. It doesn't really matter where I get it. I focus on that and then focus on getting my leg in position, and then I work on the positioning of the arm. Because once I'm over and I've got a consolidated grip on their shoulder – I mean, such a dominant position. Like their head's buried into the mat. Their arm is like, you know, sort of exposed. They're kind of like, fuck, they're gripping their arm, like figuring out where the fuck they can go. So it's such a dominant position if you can end up there.
And it's directly correlated with how strong the shoulder clamp or what are the Danaher guys call it? The shoulder, shoulder crunch, I think is the other name. I call it a shoulder clamp, because for me, that resonates better with how much you need to really clamp that shoulder in. But same crunch, thing, shoulder clamp, shoulder crunch. But it's so strong. Like even tonight at training, I had one of the guys, we started standing, and he intentionally let me get an underhook so he could put a whizzer, right? Okay. Because he wanted a takedown that, you know, you do from a whizzer position. And then there was a moment where I felt that I could ditch whatever was going on the other side. I can't quite remember. And I grabbed that shoulder clamp position from standing, and then which was on. So the shoulder clamp from where I was on my left side, meaning his right shoulder, but on my left side. So I just put my right hook in, sat down, and it's like, so as I pulled guard, he's feeling like, well, it's free for me to putt. And then I just had this your typical shoulder clamp, shoulder crunch sweep. And like, it's just so strong, man. It's so strong. I absolutely love it. Mm. And my lanky forearms definitely help with the leverage
that I can generate. Really flare that elbow as well.
I can flare the elbow way more than, I mean, obviously I've got the, on the flip side, you can probably crunch harder than I can.
Yeah, that's
what
I was thinking.
But like I can flare harder than you can.
Exactly. So that's why I'm thinking that I generally gear toward focusing on that crunch, not so much. Like sometimes I get the elbow flip, you know, the wrist flip rather. But I really focus on that crunch to get the entry. Whereas do you find that you more get the flip first with the flare and then?
I do, yeah. So it's quite an interesting difference in almost in anatomy, right? That like you're finding that you're way better at the crunch. So if you can get the crunch and then the leg, you're then going to be able to get the flip. Whereas, I mean, if I go crunch, leg over, I can then sometimes get the flip. Well, a lot of the time I get the flip, but like I'm stronger at the ability to flare my elbows than you might be.
Yeah, definitely. You know? Yeah.
And so I lean into that. Whereas for you, you might lean into that, the strength you have in crunching in, and you'll flip that shit later.
Exactly.
So it's quite interesting, you know, and reminds me of, said this before, I often, when I come across other instructors or other people who do a position that I like really well, regardless of their belt level, I'll ask them how they do it. So let's say it's true bars, something I've become really good at, or let's say it's, you know, lapel guard, something I'm really good at in the gi. I'll ask other people how they do it, because maybe they have that 1%, 2% that will improve, not necessarily change the way I do it, but I can I know enough about jiu-jitsu that I can cherry pick details or whatever to make it work for me. Anyway, let's go into some footlocks while we got some time. So I want to talk about straight footlocks a little bit. This is a submission that I probably was really bad at and wrote off completely until brown or black belt. Wow. I was really quite average at this straight footlock. Not because I couldn't get to the position. So the position, getting to the position is, I mean, I guess it gets more complicated if you're looking at no-gi and heel hooks and leg entries and whatever, but just to really dumb it down, it's just essentially getting to X guard, single leg X, to really dumb it down, right? Again, I'm stripping it back to super bare bones. So getting to the position was never a problem. It was just being able to generate enough pressure, enough torque, enough, you know, pain, whatever is necessary to make my opponent tap. And I know we already spoke a lot about Troy bars, but I want to mention the two sort of things that made it click for me, and that really made it now one of my best submissions. You ask a lot of my students, and I'm sure you felt my straight footlock from before you moved. A
couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times, which has since improved, right? Because I've been working on it, but fuck, you know, but I mean, it's like it hurts a lot. And straight footlocks, I think, are severely underrated because they got written off once, I guess, heel hooks came on the scene. But it's very, very, very well documented by guys way more successful than you and I. Like, multiple times you hear Craig Jones talk about how hard it is, whether it's in a seminar or on a podcast or whatever, but multiple times I've heard Craig Jones, one of the best leg lockers in the world, talk about how hard it is to heel hook someone when you're sweaty. Like, once you're 10 minutes into a, or whatever, 5 minutes into a match, or, and you're drenched in sweat, and you're talking about the best guys in the world at like being able to clear the knee line and slip the heel, like how hard it is to heel hook someone and how your priorities have to change in them as the match goes on. Straight footlocks are fucking awesome, man. And probably in recent history, the person who's done it the best is Mikey Musumeci. He used to hit in the gi a Kaio Terra straight footlock, which is, I personally think, is incredibly difficult. I can't really do it at all. Even in a drilling scenario, I can't really do a Kaio Terra straight footlock. But Mikey Musumeci can. However, he's also a black belt from Kaio Terra, so.
You'd hope he anyway, could.
Yeah. Anyway, there were two main things that made me really, really change the way I think about it. And now I love the position. One is, and I'll do the simpler thing first, which is kind of out of order, because the second thing I'm going to mention is what I prioritize. However, let me just get the simple thing out of the way. The thing that changed for me with straight footlocks was they just weren't working at all. And I just kind of said to myself, you know what? I didn't say I'm going to rip it, as in I'm just going to like fucking like I don't care if I hurt my partner. But I kind of just said to myself, you know what? Like, I've been straight footlocked a lot of times where I felt like my shin was going to break in half. I actually lost a competition at Blue Belt, I think it was, where I remember my opponent turned belly down and I was looking at my leg and I could see my whole shin, like the bottom half of my leg bowing, like bending, and it wasn't like the visual prompt is what made me tap. It hurt like a motherfucker. But I remember in the moment specifically thinking, I'm not breaking do you have two bones that go down your shin, right? Or one? Two bones? Anatomy's fallen by the wayside here. However, I was like, I'm not like, this competition is not worth a bone breaking. I remember.
Yeah, two. Yeah.
You have the tibia and the
fibula, of course.
And the fibula. And I was like, I'm not having one of these break for this competition. But I had this change where I was like, I started thinking about the footlock where I was like, okay, maybe it's not perfectly locked in, but there's plenty of times where I've had a rear naked choke not perfectly locked in. And for anyone who's trained more than 6 months, you know the feeling, but whatever submission it is, you know the feeling between it being perfectly locked in and it being 90% locked in or 80% locked in or 50% locked in, whatever it is, right? There's plenty of times where I've finished rear naked chokes while their chin's digging into the muscle in my forearm or into my bicep. There's plenty of arm bars I've finished that have cost me a testicle. There's plenty of times where I've finished submissions that haven't been perfectly locked in. And I kind of just, I don't know why I hadn't had this thought before, but I just started thinking about straight footlocks like that. I thought, well, maybe it doesn't have to be completely perfectly locked in. And that thought connected with the thought of a Lego figurine. So take a Lego figurine, right? And ignore the legs, but look at the arms of a Lego figurine. And you know how you can actually remove the little like yellow bit of its hand and wrist of a little Lego figurine? I was like, that's what I'm going to do to your foot. Like I started thinking about that little yellow. No, I'm not joking, bro. I was like, I'm literally going to remove your foot from your ankle. It doesn't need to be fully locked in, but if if something south of the ankle is locked in a vice, which is obviously my armpit, bicep, lat muscle, whatever, I am going to remove it the same way that I pop a Lego man's hand out from the arm. That was the first realization I had, which didn't result. I haven't hurt a single student, training partner doing that. This is not me saying like, oh, I just fucking started ripping them. It wasn't like that. It was that Lego man analogy in conjunction with the realization of, well, you're telling me you've only ever finished a rear naked choke when it was perfectly locked in. You're telling me you've never armbarred someone, gotten the tap, but it hurt your nuts. You're telling me you've never cross collar choked someone, but like it wasn't perfectly locked in and you fucked your wrist a little bit in the process. Like, yes, like how many times do you submit people where it's not perfectly locked in? But for some reason, I had this feeling that straight footlocks had to be perfectly locked in before I could apply any pressure. And so maybe that's a me thing. Like maybe people listening to this are thinking you're a moron. Like I'm well past that stage, but that was the first thing that really occurred to me. And the way that I did that, because I was thinking about it like the Lego man, that had a compounding effect, because then I would really focus on the separation between the ankle and the hip. So for those who don't know, there's a thing in physios use this term a lot. They talk about gapping a joint. So gapping a joint is a very common rehab process. So let's say you've had some type of knee injury. I don't want to say what knee injuries require this treatment because I'm not qualified to mention that. But I've had multiple knee injuries that part of the rehab process has been I've needed to gap my knee joint. And what gapping means essentially means like stretching or opening the joint. So a way you would gap your knee is put a tennis ball, for example, in the knee pit, you know, so behind your knee, and then just kind of like bounce and pull your heel to your butt. And because there's an object there, it kind of gaps the joint open. Mm-hmm. If an opponent can bring their hip closer to their foot, you kind of lose a bit of ability to gap the heel. And remember, I had gone down this rabbit hole of thinking, I'm going to remove your foot the same way I remove a Lego arm. I was thinking about literally like pulling it apart like out of an anime.
Yeah.
So that had this compounding effect of me really focusing on my leg position and removing the ability of my opponent to bring their hip closer to their foot. So whether that means you're in single leg X outside ashy, whether that means a lot of the time I'm just putting both feet on that hip and then deadlifting to remove the foot outside of the leg. And that alone resulted in a massive spike in my ability to finish straight foot locks.
So it's the difference in thinking between focusing on purely dorsiflexing the foot, right? So fully extending the foot, right? So straight foot lock, you know, you get the grip and then you talk to like lean back. So the foot, you know, keeps bending past the breaking point. But what you're saying is you've focused on instead gapping it, meaning putting more pressure on their hip or stopping them from getting their hip to their ankle. So instead of just, you know, bending the foot, you're fucking removing the ankle bone from the body.
Yeah, I'm literally like thinking about it like I'm ripping the foot off. Like yeah, almost yeah. like there's no torque, as in yeah. there's no twist. I'm literally just like as if the foot and the leg were modular. I'm just ripping, I'm just popping it off. So that was the first thing. The second thing, though, is a bit more technical. So Kieran touched on it with dorsiflex. For those who don't know, dorsiflex means like pointing your toes. There's three main ways you finish a straight foot lock. The first doesn't work anymore, which is where the name of a straight foot lock comes from. It's just hyperextending the foot, like pointing the toes past the point that they want to be pointed. People don't tap from that anymore.
Sorry, just to clarify,
dorsiflex is flexing the foot, pulling your toes.
It up.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Plantar flexion is what we're talking about. Plantar flexion.
Yeah,
you get the point.
Yeah. So that's how it used to be done, just by having the foot hyperextended, plantar flexion, right? The toes pointed beyond what they want to be pointed. But people don't tap from that anymore. The game's evolved, right? Mm. So then people started modifying the straight foot lock into what essentially was a toe hold. The pressure was the same. They would be plantar flexing, pointing the toes to some degree, but then adding some form of rotation, which still works, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not the most efficient way to do a straight foot lock. The most efficient way to do a straight foot lock is essentially an Aoki lock, which is still in the rules considered a straight foot lock, but it applies heel hook-ish pressure. And I want to say ish because it's not quite the same as a heel hook. It's way more localized to the ankle than it is to the knee. Most people would know that a heel hook, while you may feel it in your ankle first, will actually blow out your knee, ACL, MCL, LCL, you know, maybe even your PCL, I don't know, maybe. But it's way more localized to your knee, whereas an Aoki lock is way more to your ankle. So the next realization I had was going down that path. And I managed to find a way where I do a straight foot lock that I would say is in between a straight foot lock and an Aoki lock. An Aoki lock, and if you Google this, A-O-K-I, if you type in Aoki lock, for those who don't know what it is, a million things will come up. It's named after Shinya Aoki, who invented the submission. A full Aoki lock, you'll see how much the heel pops out. Mm. Whereas the variation I do, which again, it's either a straight foot lock or an Aoki lock, whatever you want to call it, is way more subtle. Because what I personally found with Aoki locks is a if we're talking about just from a straight footlock position, we're not talking about from a saddle or double treble or whatever. We're just talking about from single leg X-ish position. A full Aoki lock allows a lot more freedom for your opponent to spin out, whereas this variation that I found has the exact same mechanics with next to no ability to spin out. And the ability to apply heel hook-ish pressure is so, so painful and so savage. And it also doesn't matter if your opponent brings their hip closer to their foot, similar to what I was saying before, as long as you can then keep their hip on the mat. It becomes, in my opinion, the most savage straight foot lock that is allowed at white belt, even because it's still considered a straight foot lock. And I personally think it's one of the most brutal straight foot locks that you can do. And I absolutely love this submission now.
Can you talk us through how you would set it up and specifically what differentiates your positioning? Specifically, I want like your hand, like what grip are you taking on it? Are you like just focusing on really gapping, stomping down on the hip? Can you talk us through that?
So when you think about a typical straight foot lock, whether that's just plantar flexion, pointing the toes, mm-hmm. or adding some rotation with a toe hold-ish effect, you kind of have the knuckles of your opponent's toes in the back of your armpit, mm-hmm. right? And then where your armpit goes kind of points the toe and starts to rotate the toe. What I'm looking for is having the inside of the big toe knuckle, just the big toe knuckle, the inside of it in the back of my armpit. So then when my armpit drops, it has a similar mechanic to when people dig a heel for a heel hook and their tricep kind of externally rotates the foot of the opponent. But how do we get there? The trick is to catch a straight foot lock. And then what you want to do, unlike an Aoki lock where you kind of let the whole heel pop out.
Slip.
Yep. Yeah, you let the whole heel kind of pop out onto your belly almost for a slight exaggeration. But again, for those who are a bit lost, Google Aoki lock and you'll see what I mean. The kind of whole
Jeremy
heel.
Jeremy Skinner's got a really good video on YouTube.
Well, there you go. So Google Jeremy Skinner Aoki lock mm-hmm. and you'll see majority of the heel comes out. Mm-hmm. The issue I found with this is, people then spinning out. Unless it's done from a double treble position or some sort of position where you can mitigate the amount of spin they can do.
Like saddle or something.
Yeah. Whereas what I do is I just, you can't even see it. You can only feel it. I let such a small amount of the heel out that it's just rather than the heel being, let's say for, to give people something tangible, rather than the heel being digging into my lat, their heel is now digging into my floating rib, right? Okay. So it's only a little bit. The heel's not on my belly at all, right? Then once the foot is there, the arm that's holding it, so let's say my left arm is the arm that's attacking the foot. Once the heel is in my rib, I then punch that arm all the way across my midsection, completely across my midsection, like all the way across. Mm. And then as far as to gable grip it on my far hip. So then my supporting forearm locks it into place. Now it doesn't come back because now my supporting forearm is bumping into my far hip. So now it doesn't come back from where it locked in. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep. Right, so it's kind of like that seatbelt that you're creating like a seatbelt across your own body, right? And you're gable gripping it into place on your far hip.
Yeah, gable gripping it into place on my far hip. So no matter how much that left arm wants to come back, it can't because my right forearm is hitting into my own hip.
Yes.
Right?
Yep, yep.
What you'll find happens when you do like that
a,
is...
Sorry, you're making a right angle.
Exactly, making a right angle on the far hip, right?
Yeah, yeah, honestly.
And what you'll find happens when you do that, providing you have slipped the heel to the adequate amount, is two things. One, their foot will externally rotate to the point where the inside of their big toe knuckle is catching in the back of your armpit. Mm. And two, their ankle will start to rotate in the 100% the opposite direction you think about when you roll your ankle or twist your ankle. Like think about the way your ankle twists when you're walking or you're playing tennis or whatever, and you're jogging, and you have that whole like, oh, I twisted my ankle. Which way does your ankle rotate?
Rolls in.
It rolls in, right? You'll find when you do this, the ankle rolls out. So now I've got a huge amount of tension in the ankle that is being rolled out the way that there's zero give in the ankle. The big toe knuckle is in the back of my armpit. So when I drop my shoulder, I externally rotate the foot even more. My forearm is wedged up underneath the outside of the ankle. And my feet are planted on their hip. So
two feet on the hip?
I try to go 2 feet. Yeah. Funnily enough, the most important foot in this variation is your inside leg.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense because you have the more leverage to stomp.
Yeah, so they plant, even if they scoot their hip in, you just bridge. And what happens is when you start to bridge, remember, we've made a right angle T-bar frame across our midsection. So when I bridge, I lift up that bridge pushes into my forearm, which lifts up, that pushes into the outside of their ankle. But yeah. Hey, hang on a second. The other half of their foot is trapped behind my armpit.
Yeah.
And it is just, it's not even a heel hook. It's like.
You're literally snapping their foot. Like
the way this straight, it seems ridiculous to call this a straight foot lock.
Anything but.
The way this straight foot lock feels is, I'll give you guys an example. It's like this. I want for anyone who's lost, just do this example for me. Close your eyes, right? So you're with me.
As long as you're not driving.
That's right. You're going to.
Operating heavy machinery.
You're going to lie down on the sidewalk, right? And you're going to lie down on your right side, okay? And you're going to lie down and leave your right foot off the edge of the curb, right? Just so your ankle bone is still on the curb, but your foot is dangling in free space. Mm-hmm. And then someone comes along, an American History X stomps on your foot down to the ground. That's the way the ankle is breaking. So it's not, so that's why I say heel hook-ish. There's a lot of external rotation, but it's not attacking the knee at all. It is, it's like 100% in the ankle, but
go back to the example. You have it on your left side, right? And I know this is turning into similar to the Choi Bar episode. People are going to be lost, but. You know, fuck it. So you have it.
Kieran's like, this is my episode. I need to know what I'm working on for the next 3 months.
But I've got the visual aids. I'm like listening. I'm imagining the curb stomp. Okay, so you've got whatever, their right leg, say, and you're attacking it with your left. It's in your left. We'll keep that example. You're lying on your right side, right?
No. Oh, sometimes it's either right side or neutral. The thing you don't want to be with this variation is
it can't be buried.
So if my left arm is the submission arm, I can't be on my left side because I want to externally rotate the foot and then break it down into that curb stomp position. If I'm lying on my left side, the mat is supporting the foot.
You can do this standing when they're standing, but you need to take their foot off the mat, right?
Yeah, which goes for all straight foot locks. So yeah. I filmed a video not long ago for my for this. I've made my own fucking Instagram and shit. And anyway, so I filmed some videos, and I filmed a video on straight footlock defense that was just like essentially just stand up, motherfuckers. Like if you're standing up, your foot's flat on the mat, your foot is supported by the mat. They can't hyperextend, torque your foot if it's on the mat, right? Just stand up. You all suck. Something along those lines. But again, it's a little 30-second video. You can be straight footlocked when you're standing up. However, if you've ever been straight footlocked, or if you are going to be straight footlocked from listening to this episode onwards while you're standing up, I guarantee you, stop and ask yourself, did they manage to take my foot off the mat and submit me? Like, yeah, maybe I was still standing, but was my foot flat on the mat when I got straight footlocked? And I bet you it was no. Tyo Terra straight footlock that, like, there are variations of a straight footlock that you can get caught in with your foot flat on the mat, but they are very far and few between, and there's like three people in the world that can do it. So as a overarching statement, if your foot's flat on the mat, you can't get straight footlock. So you can do it against a standing opponent, but you will have to push them in a way that you can get their foot off the mat.
I just sent you that video. So I sent Adam a video on WhatsApp, the no-gi comp I did, where I got two straight footlock finishes. But one in particular that I want you to look at, if you can, if you go to 2:24, and I'll put a link to this in the description. Is this position? So if you just go to like literally 2:24 and then just stop the video there, and it's like screenshot. See how my opponent's heel is like, how his like heel and leg is sort of rotated. Is this a similar position?
Yeah, it's not too dissimilar. Like, I mean, I would say
the other way, obviously, his foot need. Yeah, okay.
No. It's not too dissimilar. Like, I mean, but the reason that this is working in this instance, so I assume Kieran's going to put a link in the description want a specific reference to what we're talking about. If you pause the video at 2:44, 2:45.
2:24.
Sorry. I'm looking at one at 2:45.
Yeah, there's two. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was looking at the one at 2:24. So the one where he's standing.
Oh, sorry. Okay, hang on. Give me a second. Let me go back. No, that's different. The standing one at 2:24, that's definitely just a whole lot of plantar flexion and a little bit of toe hold-ish.
Yeah, because he's sort of twisting, but he's putting himself in that. But if we go to two,
the point that I'm making remains, like his foot is off the ground.
Yes.
Right? Like if his foot was flat on the ground and he was pushing weight through that foot, he wouldn't be getting straight foot locked.
And if you actually do go to one at 2:03, that is actually more closely to what you're talking about, because his heel has slipped a little bit. It is on my floating rib. I just realized.
Yeah. So, but the reason, like I said, if you're attacking it with, in this case, in the video, your right arm, you don't want to be on your right side. You're not on your right side. You've essentially turned belly down, which has allowed the space for you to get that angle.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can see it's there. The foot is even rotating a similar way to what you're describing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the perfect example of how the mechanics of this and why it's so strong is the American History X example. And yeah, you reference guys like Craig Jones or whatever, who will tell you as the match goes on and you get sweatier, it's so hard to heel hook people. Obviously, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I could be covered in KY jelly and Craig Jones would still heel hook me. We're talking one of the top, you know, 1, 2, 3 guys in the world, of course. But I mean, if you're talking it when things are even, straight footlocks are such a stronger way to kind of just hold on to the leg and the foot. And if you get good at them, not only will it improve your, you know, your leg lock game, But it also 100% applies to gi. For so for people who train both or whatever, whereas like obviously, you know, heel hooks are only a no gi thing, right? Until maybe one day the rules change in the future, who knows? But currently in 2023, heel hooks are just a no gi thing, whereas straight foot locks are in both.
Okay, I have a question for you. What do you think about that rear naked choke grip that people like to do? So you've dug the heel.
I personally don't. Oh, on the heel hook or straight foot lock?
Sorry, straight foot lock. So you this is very much just plantar flexion. I don't really see.
I personally don't like it. I
found the same. I don't like it either. I think that the finishing mechanic there is fucking weak compared to a simple gable grip or even like a hand over fist grip, like a kind of like you're doing a guillotine on it with like a high wrist almost.
Although, like I never use that grip for a finish, but I would use that
for control. For control.
For control.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was funnily enough, I was telling a training partner, I was teaching him straight foot locks and straight foot locks defense fucking last week. And I said that exact thing. So I'm just so glad that, you know, it's correct. You're backing me up. That rear naked choke grip where the hand on bicep, the heel is in the crook of your elbow and you have the other hand on their shin. The shin bone, you control there, because if they try and pull you know they're not going anywhere.
Yeah,
right?
not only do you control, but I specifically use that grip when I'm trying to set up this variation of a straight foot lock, which one of the guys, but not so much about that. Ollie, who Kieran knows, Ollie's one of our brown belts. He came in the other day and he was asking me questions about it, and he's like, so when you do the child's lock, blah blah blah, and I was like, the what? I was like, yeah, that straight foot lock you do. And I was like, oh, bro, it's just like, fuck, what? It's a straight foot lock, man. It's an Aoki lock.
Child
like,
lock.
It's not, you know. And then that snowballed into, I think we were calling it the Steve Irwin lock or something. I don't know. But anyway, I use that control. If I'm trying to set up this variation of a straight foot lock when I've got a standing opponent, I will use that control, the rear naked choke, like hand on the bicep, then hand on their shin grip for two specific reasons. Not because I think they're going to pull their foot out. That like it's more because I can do two things. One, the hand that's on their shin, I can help to push that out to make sure they don't internally rotate their knee too much. Mm-hmm. Which if I want the lock, or if we're talking about gi matches, I don't want like heel hooks off the table, so I don't want them to internally rotate their knee.
Because if they did that in no gi, they internally rotate their knee, they expose the heel all day.
Which either you take that, or maybe you're not very good at outside heel hooks, so you don't want that, right? Whatever it is. But I use that hand on the shin to try to force the external rotation, and also to like, I need to have their heel slip a little bit. So that hand on the shin, I use that to like to feed out their foot, their foot, to feed out their heel enough until I catch it, and then boom, and then palm to palm, dig it. But in terms of a finish mechanic, I don't like it.
So just to clarify, where is their heel, like their Achilles heel almost, orientate that for me. Where is that on your arm?
It would probably be halfway up my forearm.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm just thinking a lot of like with the grip where it's like, you know, hand over fist or whatever, when you finish that, you know, traditional plantar flexion style, a lot of the time it's up near your wrist, almost like the position you want a heel hook on the blade of your forearm. But what you're saying is because you're punching it all the way across, gable gripping on the far hip, creating the seatbelt, creating that T, it's shifted up more, so it's like halfway up your forearm and then it's a little bit slipped onto your floating rib. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And then you crunch into it, right? You crunch down into it. Yeah.
It's 100% a combination of my Lego Man analogy and the mechanics of how this works, because a huge part of this straight foot lock is essentially
gapping like hip, right?
Well, no, but but it's also just like getting on board with, man, like I understand the heels digging into your ribs, that hurts a little bit, you know, the side of the ankle bone is pushing into your lat, that hurts a little bit because it's a bony thing pushing into you, but like that foot is locked down. Like, I want you to go back to being in high school in woodworking class when you literally clamp shit into a vise. It is locked in a fucking vise. And if I move my body this way, like, I'm taking it with me, you know, like, and if I take it with me and I keep their hip over there, shit don't bend that way.
So the breaking mechanics, so we've got it down. We know where it is on our forearm. We know where the heel is in our hip. We know where our palms are, you know, connected, blah, blah, blah. We're on the left. We're attacking on the left side. Then we drop our left shoulder down and essentially deadlift away. So we drop down and away, right? And also keep that pressure on the hip.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, to simplify it. Yeah. I would, this is the sort of thing though that honestly, like we could talk about it for hours.
You need to feel it?
I mean, a little bit. Like, I mean, I've taught this multiple times.
Yeah.
And I've been refining it. And yeah, I mean, specifically refining it even more over the last 3 months. But I mean, I've had white, blue, purple, brown, black belts that I've taught this to and that I've spent a whole hour class with, and they still can't quite get it. Like, this for me would definitely fall into like the bucket of one of those submissions that's super nuanced. Mm. Again, it's not a new submission. I didn't invent anything. It's just this way that I do it. I honestly believe, like, if you can get on board with it, it is so, so fucking crazy strong. But there's a lot of students I've taught this to that I've kind of needed to say, like, that I'll let them do it on me, and I'll say something along the lines of, hang on, let me do it on you so you can feel what you're trying to achieve. And then they're like, oh, holy fucking shit. And then they get it. You know, like, it's really nuanced. It makes me think of north-south chokes. They're actually way more complicated than, you know, people do it and they're essentially doing an upside-down guillotine and people tap from the neck crank and whatever. But to do a north-south choke correctly, it's actually really fucking difficult, you know. And there's a submission that I've taught multiple times, but there's a lot of – a million different ways I try explain it, because one way might get through the head of this person, another way might get through the head of the other person. But yeah, to summarize, the two things that really changed straight footlocks for me was A, just locking it in like a vice and removing the foot like a Lego man arm, and B, incorporating essentially an Aoki lock mechanic. And this was a submission that I wrote off until brown black belt, whereas now it's one of my best submissions. Maybe not one of my go-tos, because for my game it doesn't fit into it, but in terms of one of my submissions, it's 100% one of my best, and it works gi, no gi. It's a fucking baller.
That's really interesting. That was good. Thank you.
That brings me to my something interesting, okay, which actually perfectly segues into what we're talking about. And for those who don't know, let me bring up Mikey Musumeci recently fought on the ONE Championship, which was October 6th, okay? And which is funny, like, ONE Championship does a whole bunch of different events. I was a little unaware of how much different shit they do. They do MMA events, jiu-jitsu events, Muay Thai events, and apparently I saw a reel popped up with me and they're like number two behind UFC and in terms of like how much viewers and whatever they get. Anyway, yeah. Mikey obviously has some sort of contract with them because he's fought with them quite a lot.
Yes.
But on October 6th, he fought Shinya Aoki.
Yep.
This fight you can find for free. It's on YouTube.
I'll put a link to it in the description.
Doesn't go for very long. Mikey essentially like does the Gordon Ryan trick that Gordon was doing back in ADCC, just being like, oh, here's a single leg so you can take me down. Because I believe in the ONE rules, you're not allowed to pull guard, or you're not allowed to just sit down and butt scoot. You have to aggressively pull guard.
Okay.
But Mikey finished Shinya Aoki, the guy who invented the Aoki lock, with an Aoki lock.
Yep.
Which is...
What a baller move.
What is baller? But that's actually not the the something interesting. I mean, it is the something interesting, but I just wanted to read the quote that Mikey said after the match, because if you don't know who Mikey Musumeci is, or if you do but you're not already a fan of his, man, the dude's a fucking class act. So this is what he said after the match. Quote, "The position I hit was called an Aoki lock. It's a modified heel hook, but I learned this position from Shinya Aoki. It's his submission that he invented. When I think of what a master of jiu-jitsu is, it's somebody that inspires another generation, and then they're doing the positions that you created. So Shinya deserves so much credit. I did his move on him. So that's like a master to student." Mm. You know, so it wasn't like Mikey went out there and was like, I'm the best in the world and I'm going to submit Shinya Aoki with an Aoki lock. Like, I mean, prior to that, he was digging a heel hook. He was looking for a heel hook or a Mikey lock or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I think Mikey Mush is a class act. That Aoki lock is the segue to what I was talking about. It's a very similar to what I've been describing. Again, the foot lock I've been describing this episode, you could call it a straight foot lock or an Aoki lock. It's kind of in between the two. But,
yeah, and if you go specifically to this video at 1 minute, 39 seconds, is a really awesome top-down view. You pause it there, take a note of the positioning of
how much heel comes out.
Not only how much heel comes out, but the fact that he, instead of using like a gable grip on the far hip like you're describing, he uses that like a rear naked choke, but he doesn't reinforce the top hand on the shin. He keeps it like up. So it's pretty much just a bicep grip, right? He's locking down his hand on his bicep, keeping the other hand up near his face. And that is the finishing mechanic. So it is all the way across. His heel has slipped out and that's the finish.
Yeah. But you can see, right, compared to what I was talking about, very different. Like the whole heel is out.
Yes.
I don't want to say very different, like I've invented something. It's the same thing, but you know,
finish. It's a different, like the details are different. He's also, Mikey is gapping the hip on Aoki's rib. So instead of stomping down with the top leg on the hip, he's actually stomping down more like up on the rib of Aoki.
Yeah, super, which I don't know, like whether that was intentional or that's just ended up in the moment.
Yeah. I think he just fucking gripped and ripped.
But that was it. That was my something interesting. If you want to check that out, guys, just type in Mikey Musumeci versus Shinya Aoki, or Kieran will put the link. The fight's for free on YouTube. You can find it. He subs him like 2 minutes in or something. But yeah, I mean, I think Mike is a class act. And yeah, off to you, bro. What have you got?
So I said to Adam that I do actually have something interesting for my something interesting, but it's got nothing to do with jiu-jitsu. So it's a good closer, I suppose. It's a good segue. I'm glad we did it in that order. Okay, so I was talking with a friend of mine on the way back from the competition, because we carpooled down to the competition on Saturday. And I don't know how, but the conversation just went off on a random tangent. And he was telling me about this video that he saw. And the video is asking hunter-gatherers life's toughest questions. And he sent it to me and I watched it this morning, actually. And it is super fucking interesting, because basically it's this YouTube channel, this guy, it's called Fearless and Far. And he spent some time with Hadza tribe it's a remote African tribe of hunter-gatherers in the African country of Tanzania. And he basically spent time with them, hunted with them, asked some questions and you know, documented their life. So they are not like isolated in a sense that they don't have any interaction with the outside world, but they just live their lives. They're pretty much one of the few remaining true hunter-gatherer tribes in the world. And he asked the head of the tribe, the head hunter, if you will, some questions. A lot was lost in translation, but it's very, very interesting. The questions that he was asking was, what is the meaning of life? And the response that they gave was meat. Meat is the meaning of life, like food. Essentially, food is the meaning of life. And then he asked questions like, what is the best day in your life look like? Meat and honey. was a response. And then he asked, what does the moon represent to you? What is the meaning of the moon? And the response is nothing. The moon in the sky means nothing. Moon gives light. Light helps us hunt the baboon, right? And it was in the context of the conversation I was having with my friend, it was very, very interesting because we're talking about perspective and how everything in life can be viewed through the lens. When you view it through a lens of perspective and where you come from and what is important to you at that moment. And an analogy that I use is similar to if you ask a drowning person what the most important thing to them is or what they want most in the world, that's how air, they want to breathe, right? And I'm not saying that, you know, being a hunter-gatherer is like drowning. What I'm saying is when your life is full of hardship in terms of you need to actually source and gather your own food, it becomes the priority in your life. You don't worry about things that, you know, in modern day society, we think about constantly and worry about and argue about and, you know, silly things that don't matter, like, you know, very niche political ideas and cultural niche ideas and things that people get really up in arms and left versus right and all this shit. When you boil it down to the basic essential human survival, it's so fucking interesting when you talk to these people that it's, you know, and the most important thing to them.
It is interesting. Like, I don't want to go on a whole nother 2-hour episode on what, you know, tangent or can of worms that could be. But yeah, obviously when, you know, it's very primal, right? Like it's not too dissimilar to if you could directly communicate with a fucking lion in the plains of Africa, what the meaning of life is, they would tell you like to fucking hunt something and kill it and eat it and then reproduce and make babies. And, you know, that's essentially life as a whole. That's the cycle, right? You know, you eat enough and then you reproduce for the next generation, whatever. But it definitely, yeah, it's interesting. Just that thought of how that leads on to where we currently live. So, you know, if we come full circle to go back to what we were talking about at the start, you lost a competition at blue belt. Oh, it's just a blue belt competition. Oh, but it matters to me because I'm a blue belt. You go like, oh, well, this person didn't like my Facebook post. Like, yeah, okay, that's not going to matter to the hunter-gatherer, but it's going to matter to the 15-year-old girl at high school that, you know, is trying to get a date for prom or whatever. And it's like, well, it's all relative to the world that you live in. And, you know, if you want to interact with a, like, you know, whatever, let's say something as trivial as people complain about, you know, fucking taxes and this and that. And it's like, well, okay, well, you can't like not pay the taxes and have free healthcare. You know, like, I mean, like if you want to interact with the society and that you're living in and the world you're living in, you know,
just like imagining all the Americans being like free healthcare. What the fuck? Yeah,
As I said,
we pay taxes and yeah. Go. But see, Americans pay like, you know, if their income tax is like 20%, they're like, oh, taxes in this state is outrageous. It's 20% or something like that. Bro, Scandinavia, the tax pressure in Sweden is 55%. What
Holy
the fuck?
Shit.
That's insane. That's socialism huge. Is wild, bro.
That's
it's
huge.
Wild. My wife's pointing at me like, ah.
But anyway, but it is interesting, right? Because obviously those lines blur, like when you move out from being, you know, obviously a solely hunter-gatherer tribe is, you know, one extreme of what we were however many hundreds or thousands of years ago. I don't know. But yeah, it's also interesting when you speak to people who kind of fly that flag but also want to live in modern day society and, you know, it's like, well, there's certain rules and regulations that go with living in, you know, modern day society. Anyway, that's a whole different thing that I'm not knowledgeable enough to really,
I get what you're saying.
You know, comment on, but it's interesting. So, what was again the video or YouTube channel?
I put a link to it, but the video itself is called "Asking Hunter Gatherers Life's Toughest Questions," and the channel is I'm just pulling it up. It's called Fearless and Far. So
Fearless and Far,
yeah.
That is interesting.
There you go.
There you go. All right, guys. Well, on that note, this was actually prior to recording, you would not have known, or perhaps maybe you noticed during the episode, but prior to recording, I said, Kieran, man, I'm like really low energy. I don't know if I ate something or like I'm not, let's, and we were like, yeah, okay, well, let's just, we'll make it a shorter episode. And I was like, yeah, I'm not feeling very well, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, here we are. We made it all the way to the end. Maybe you noticed during the episode that I was low energy. Maybe you didn't. As always, guys, thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions, you know where you can reach us. But otherwise, until next time, we'll catch you then.